Welcome to the latest episode of the Custom Private Equity Podcast, Private Equity in the 1960s. Today we will talk with Paul Anthony Thomas, the principal at CustomPrivateEquity.com. I'm Ron Davis, experienced podcaster, and I'll be asking all the newbie questions. So Paul, we're kind of starting a series here where we're going to go back through last five plus decades, and we're going to talk about what was going on in each of those because you experienced those. And we're going to start sort of at the beginning of your career, which was not, you didn't just like get out of school and decide to go do this. You come from a family who was there long before that. But we're going to talk a little about private equity as it is, you know, through the decades, if you will. And we're going to start with the 1960s. So before we get started with all of that again, let's go back to our core question that, you know, people may or may not know listening to our podcast. What is private equity? When you say it, what do you mean?
So, Ron, I appreciate you being here today, and thanks for asking that question. Private equity is anytime a individual or a company puts private cash, private money, into a business deal is private equity. It's morphed and meshed all over the place over the last 40 years, 50 years. But in the beginning, private equity was John Rockefeller, one of the richest men in the world, putting money into a company to get it started, get it going, kind of a venture capital type of a thing. But they also bought companies. So whenever a company had been started by somebody in Boise, Idaho that controlled the entire grocery market, some investor would come along and say, I would like to buy your grocery company. And that would be a private equity investment. So back in the 60s and 50s and 60s, there wasn't a public company doing this, although public companies did do this. But it was more of a private individual saying, okay, I'm going to grow the world of grocery, and I'm going to buy all the big grocery distributors in the northwest part of the country, and I'm going to put this together, and then I'm going to take that company public. So that was the private equity world back then. It was a lot of mergers, a lot of acquisitions. M&A is what it was called. And that's kind of when it got started in the late 50s and early 60s.
And what, you know, as someone who was born in the mid 60s, and as I'm sure many of our people, our listeners, were not born in the 60s, what were the 60s like?
So if you were a hippie, you'd say, man, I missed the 60s because I was on drugs all the time. But so in the 1960s, the Cold War was raging. The Russia and the U.S. were just battling. They weren't battling physically, but they were battling emotionally and between each other. Stalin, who was the leader of the Russian Empire at the time, his daughter defected to the U.S., which was kind of interesting. During most of the 60s, the Lyndon Johnson was the president of the United States. The Vietnam War was raging, and Russia was involved in one side of that, and China and the U.S. was on the other side of it. In economics, interest rates were hovering around 5%, mostly, which has been like the 50-year average of interest rates, but they were hovering around 5%, which was good. It began and ended with a recession, but the growth, the middle of the decade was a growth area. In the 1960s, the science of the world, we had the first cryopreservation where a person put himself in cryo storage trying to preserve himself for future generations. That's where the whole artificial insemination world came from. And so a tremendous number of scientific exploration and scientific things came from the 60s. In music, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix were big, The Doors, Grateful Dead, The Beatles had released their Magical Mystery Tour album. Simon and Garfunkel recorded Mrs. Robinson, and Aretha Franklin recorded the song Respect. Woodstock took place in the 60s. Entertainment, color TV was the number one mode of entertainment during this decade. Hair opened on Broadway. It was the first nude musical. Which was a very interesting time. Movies had their heyday, The Jungle Book by Disney, Sound of Music, The Graduate, Butch Cassidy, Sundance Kid, Goldfinger, which was one of the third episode of the Bond series. The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, which is a Clint Eastwood movie. Planet of the Apes came into being, which was very futuristic movie at the time. Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. The first Boeing 737 flew, which is what makes up Southwest Airlines' entire fleet today. PBS was born. Sesame Street was born. Thurgood Marshall in the Civil Rights Movement. Thurgood Marshall was the first black member of the Supreme Court. Until then, we had had no real black members of the U.S. government much to speak of. There had been a few. There were race riots. The Civil Rights Act was in place, and Lyndon Johnson signed that and actually set off riots all around the United States, Minneapolis, Buffalo, Newark, Dallas. Abilene had riots, where I live. West Texas had riots. You wouldn't think that they would, but it did, but they did. Martin Luther King was assassinated, and towards the end of the decade, Nixon was elected, which is not the greatest president we've ever had. So some people think he is, but I don't generally think he was. So it was a very dynamic decade.
Yeah, and it's interesting as you mention these things. It's, it does sound a little familiar. Did they have a plague?
Did they have a plague? No, they didn't have a plague, but they had a lot of unrest in the world, just like we have today. Yeah,
they did. So that's the backdrop of where you're starting out. You're starting out as a private equity investor and advisor and that kind of thing. So you mentioned the economy a little bit, but what was the investing world like in those times?
Well, the New York Stock Exchange was the largest exchange on the planet at the time. It had 4,300 stocks, including 644 different bond offerings on the public markets. One of the interesting things that's not present today that was present back then is that there were lots of regional exchanges. There was one in Boston. There was a stock exchange in Chicago. There was one in Cincinnati, in Detroit. The New York Stock Exchange, of course. The Pacific Coast had one in L.A. Philadelphia had one. Pittsburgh had one. Now, all these stock exchanges have been consolidated now, and most of them don't exist anymore, although the Pacific Exchange does still exist. Colorado Springs had one. Richmond, Virginia had one. So the over-the-counter market was operating. It was called the third market. We knew it as the pink sheets back then. So my father grew up in this environment, and he actually brought me into this environment in a young age, but he bought his first stock in 1926, before the Great Depression. So he had already had 40 years of stock analysis and stock research work under his belt before he brought me into all the initial public offerings. Actually usually generated about a 25%, maybe sometimes 50% return during the first week of IPOs during the decade of 1960s. Some famous IPOs at the time were McDonald's, Target, Apache Corporation, which is a large oil company today, H&R Block, L Brands, which is a huge clothing company today. Rules were being made that actually prevented people from doing what we consider to be criminal acts today. Insider trading rules were put in place at that point in time. Takeover bill passed, which required anybody that bought more than a 10% stake of the public stock of a publicly traded company to actually make a registration. Today, that number's down below 5%. Suitability rules for investors came into place. So when a broker was not able to put it after this rule passed, he was not able to put someone in a public stock that the investment was not considered to be suitable for them, which is a very interesting thing today. It's a rule that still stands today. During that period of time, the average number of initial public offerings that were offered were 15, and the total number of about $30 billion a year. The rules have not changed, and the world has not really changed all that much, but it is just larger, and inflation has made the IPOs and the value of the dollar so much lower that the IPOs are much larger today. So that was what's happening back in the 60s.
And so what did private equity look like back then?
So 1960s was the beginning of the heyday of the mergers and acquisitions world, where people would put together private pools of money, and they would use those private pools to buy private companies, and they would also buy into public companies. This is generally known as the leverage buyout world. The leverage buyout funds were big at that point in time. The major players in the leverage buyout world were Colbert, Kravis, and Roberts. Thomas Lee has a multi-billion dollar buyout fund today that he started back in the 60s. Bear Stearns was huge in this marketplace. In the venture capital world, the largest venture capital player at the time was the VinRock Fund, which is the Rockefeller family. So venture capital and private equity, they're at that point in time, they were synonymous. Venture capital was used to start new companies, which is similar to a lot of what I do. Leverage buyout world and funds were used to buy public companies mostly, and they borrowed as much money as they could. And each leverage buyout had its own reason for occurring. So some of the leverage buyouts, the funds would go in and buy the company, and they would raid the pension fund of the company, and they would use the pension money of the company to actually pay back the debt that they created whenever they made the leverage buyout. Those were called corporate raiders. So they would either use the pension fund of the company, or they would use the assets of the company. Sometimes they would leverage the assets up so high, and then when they took the company private, they would take a public company private, and then they would turn around and recondition those assets and turn around and try to take the company public again, and they would just make fortunes overnight. So the corporate raider world is when this started. Warren Buffett was never a corporate raider, but Kohlberg was. They were a huge corporate raider at the time. And they called them corporate raiders. Besides raiding the assets of the company and the pension funds of the company, they would actually make hostile takeovers. So they would go find a disgruntled shareholder that didn't have enough say in the company, and they would buy his assets, and then they'd buy a few more disgruntled investors, and then they would make a corporate raid, and they would go in and control, put their board members on the board of the corporation, and they would control the corporation's assets from that time.
And so what type of stuff were you dealing with at that time?
So most of our stuff is in the private equity world is startup type companies. So we like to do the venture capital side of things, but we also like cash flow. So we don't like risk. We stay away from risk. We stay away from debt. So we never participated in the leverage buyout part of the economy. We're after cash flow in our investments. So, we like cash flow companies and cash flow ideas that have room for growth. We managed assets in the pre-buyout stage where we would build a company and then sell it to a larger company, and which is what we do today. The offerings I have on the street are funds that we've done the process two or three times with them, and we're up and running and doing it again. An example would be oil and gas production. We're buying oil and gas production. Back then we drilled a whole lot more wells because there was a lot of oil to be found in North America, and OPEC didn't have such a big grasp on the market as they do today. We were developing real estate, both commercial and residential. We actually rented a commodities trading fund, a CTA is what it's called, commodities trading advisor, which is what CTA stands for. We didn't really do advisory. We actually raised the funds and ran a commodity trading business. We also ran a precious metals shop where we were actually storing precious metals, gold, silver, platinum, copper, those types of precious metals for investors. So we would actually go out and buy the metal for them, store it for them in our facility. And then if they wanted to trade it, we would trade it as a trading block. We wrote and edited and published investment newsletters at that point in time. The one, main one we wrote was to 10,000 investors, and it was called New Horizons for Investors. We published research and recommended private investments. We recommended public stock investments. We just did a full gambit. We were a full service private equity shop at that point in time.
And when you say we, who are you referring to? I know, but
yeah, at that point in time, it was my father and myself, and he was the one writing the newsletters, and I was in my early teens. And if I could go in and read the newsletter and understand what he had written, and if I didn't understand it, he would educate me on it. But if I could understand what he had written and understand the dynamics behind it and why he was writing about it, then he felt like he had written it properly where somebody in high school could read it and understand it. And that's where I pretty much started my career. I was editing his work and helping him write. He wrote a book called Human Psychology in the Stock Market. And we published that book during my early parts of my career. And in that book, we talked about all these different investment vehicles and how they operate and how they work and how they mesh together to make a profitable portfolio for someone.
Okay. So what type of deals did you guys manage in the 60s?
Well, basically, we were working in the oil and gas business. My father was a geologist by training at a doctorate in geology from LSU on top of 40 years of stock management and stock research career. So at that point in time, we were working on a 2-million-acre block in the Canadian Arctic. Basically, he had taken the government-issued Landsat data, which was government satellite data, and he had analyzed that data and found an oil and gas prospect in the Arctic north of Toronto, Canada. And we went together up to Canada and leased 2 million acres. We got it a concession. And he bought those for a nickel an acre. And we turned around 5 years later, he turned around and sold those for $3 an acre. So that's the type of returns that we look for whenever we're doing a private equity type deal. We started work on a 30,000-acre lease block in this northern San Juan Basin of Colorado. We were able to actually develop several prospects on that property. We did deep research into public stocks. We researched as many as 2,000 public stocks a month. I did actually at that point in time, I was doing hand charting. So I would actually go in and chart these stocks, chart the daily prices of them so we could keep up with how they were trending. We developed real estate, including raw land, commercial shopping centers. We had a partnership with a ranch management company where we had thousands of head of cattle that he would lease land and we would buy the cows and he would manage the cattle and we would take them to market. And that was from Wyoming to South Texas. That was a tremendously profitable operation for us.
Okay, cattle. You had the cattle in Wyoming. And you took them to South Texas. How did you do that? Did you drive them like with cowboys?
No, we would truck them when we moved them. But we would move the cows north in the summertime and move them back south in the wintertime. So he had land leased in Wyoming. And in the summertime, they would wind up in Wyoming where the grass was thick and nice and very rich in nutrients. And then come August, September, we would start moving them down into Colorado and down into Oklahoma. And then by wintertime, we would have them in South Texas. So we were grazing cattle year round, which was kind of an unusual thing because in the hot summertime, South Texas is a pretty dry area. So the grass doesn't grow real well. So our cattle were in Wyoming at that time. Mm-hmm. And then he would move them and they would calf out in the fall and in the spring, they would calf out usually in Oklahoma, and then we would move the calves, and we were running mother cow operations and commercial cow operations both. So, and then we would move them to South Texas in the deep winter time where they would still have green grass to grow on. And this was a tremendously profitable thing as long as the market for meat stayed up.
Right.
So that's kind of how we managed that.
When you need to cash the cows out, which is not a euphemism exactly, but did you have to take them somewhere else?
Normally we would take them to the closest auction. So in South Texas, we would take them to the San Antonio auction and sell them to Swift Premium Meats or somebody like that, somebody buying and managing meat operations for Gooch, or Gooch was a local company, but Gooch type, Swift Premium was the largest at the time, and they still are one of the largest meat processors, and they had government contracts that they had to meet, and we would be a supplier, just one of many hundreds of suppliers of meat for them. And we would do it throughout the year. I mean, this was a cash flowing thing that happened. I mean, we would have cash flow in January. We'd also have cash flow in November, December, June, July, August. Every month we would take some cows that were ready to sell and we would take them to market. So yeah, it was a continual type thing.
It was a new renewable resource.
It was a renewable resource. Still is. We're not in that market today, but that doesn't mean there's not opportunities there. We just don't have the partner to manage it.
What were the expected returns on private equity in the 60s in that world? What was sort of the expectations there?
So an example of that would be, for instance, in 1957, American Research and Development was one of the original private equity firms, and they helped start Digital Equipment, which was a huge computer company that did government computing for the census and government computing for the Internal Revenue Service and things like that. So they bought that company for $70,000, and by 1968, which was 10 years later, that company was worth $355 million. It was sold out in an IPO for $350 million. So that's an example, $70,000 to $350 million over a 10-year period of time. That's a private equity return that everybody relishes. Our private equity return in today's world is, you know, we look at companies that have a realistic ability to return a 20% return on our money. If we can find something that can return a 5x or 5 times our money, or 10x, 10 times our money in a 10-year period of time, that's great. And we look for those all the time. But our daily business is companies that have the realistic expectation of a 20 to 25% return on our money. That's right. What today's world looks like.
It's kind of funny. We're sitting here, we're talking about a computer company's IPO in 1958.
Yeah, actually the IPO happened in 1968, but yes,
the
actual start of that company happened in 1957. So yes, we're talking about 70 years ago now.
Yeah, because we think, that was a big 90s thing. And even today, you know, that's, there are companies that go public that are tech companies. But like tech is not, it's just not just computers. But in this case, we're actually talking about computers as well.
That's right. So
what was your team's strong suit back in the 1960s?
So my team's strong suit was my dad was long in the tooth in the 60s. He was born in 1913. So he was in his mid-50s, and he bought his first stock when he was a teenager.
Long in the tooth? Did you just call people in their mid-50s not long in the tooth?
Yeah, I'm long in the tooth. I'm in my mid-60s now, so I'm long in the tooth. But our team's strong suit, we had people all around us that were helping us with this, but my father and I were mainly doing most of the research. And we use the mosaic theory of investing. We use that theory today where we gather information from all different sides of an investment. We might gather information from the Wall Street Journal. We might gather information from people on the ground. Right now, we're gathering information in the oil and gas equipment business by going to oil and gas auctions and seeing where the market is every week today. Our strong suit was research, and taking this research and putting it together into a mosaic of, yes, this is where the next big thing's coming from. This is where the next big opportunity's coming from. For instance, electric cars in the 2020s are one of the large next big things that's coming to the world. We did research. We were a tremendous research team, and we are a tremendous research team today. I actually have some really great people around me today that I've brought together over the last 20 years, and we do constant research into markets. Back in the 60s, our use of government data was strong, and we used that as part of our mosaic theory. The aging of the population is an example of that today. What's the next big thing in the oil and gas market? Well, in our world, we just started a plugging company. So there are 800,000 oil wells that need to be plugged over the next 10 to 15 years. And right now, there are not enough people to do that work. So we've started a plugging company in the last 2 months to actually try to take advantage of that. In-depth research. We did research on over 2,000 public stocks. We don't do that much today because we've advanced beyond the public markets, and we deal in the private markets today. We did research into medical devices. We did research into real estate, which we constantly do today. Energy, entertainment. My son works he's a production assistant for Netflix in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He's on one of the 7 shows that's actually being produced during the COVID dilemma. So we do research like that in the entertainment world. So our mantra in today's world, and this is kind of the last word for the 1960s, is if you research and review 1,000 private equity deals in a year and you pick two or three or four or maybe five that you really think are strong, productive, safe investments, then you've really hit a home run. And that's where we are in today's world. That's the kind of success we look for. The platforms I have on the street today are those types of platforms where I've taken the world of investing and I've narrowed it down to the top two or three or five things to do with our investors' money and our partners' money. So that's where we are today.
Which is a great place to sort of wrap this up. If you want more information about today's topic or any of these kind of platforms that Paul has worked on, go to customprivateequity.com. There are a number of resources there that will teach you a little bit more about private equity. And there are also multiple ways to contact Paul directly. So once again, that URL is customprivateequity.com. Any final words, Paul?
No, Ron, I appreciate your time today, and I hope people got a lot out of this, and I hope they'll call us and become partners with us. I appreciate your time.